Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, accepting nominations now for the 2022 James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards at irvineawards.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, ensuring the voices of Californians are heard in California's decisions about healthcare. On the web at chcf.org/voices.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Today on our show, following the mass shooting in Atlanta, Asian American women talk about their experiences with discrimination. Plus, public health information about the virus is hard to find in the Punjabi language. Truck drivers are some of the most affected. But first, a Fresno encampment for those experiencing homelessness is relying on community donations to accommodate displaced people it recently took in after a highway cleanup operation. Although the city helped transport belongings to the site, FM89's Sarith Hawk tells us the city is currently not funding any of the work being done there.
Just like a few pallets and you can make anything into a deck.
Timothy Jackson is hammering together pallets at the site of his new home, an encampment near a Highway 99 overpass in downtown Fresno. The former tile and granite worker is building a railing to help with mobility for the camp's elderly members.
It's not going to go very far, but they can at least get, you know, to the bathroom when they need to.
Jackson is one of the camp's newest residents. He's been here for 4 days. His previous encampment was on Highway 168 near Shaw. But he was displaced last week after a Caltrans highway cleanup.
I basically lost everything. They bulldozed it all, so I just came here with like two bags and that's it.
Jackson says he didn't get the required 72 hours notice before Caltrans moved in.
They came the night before and said, hey, we might be coming through, whoop-whoop, and everything else. And I was like, that's not enough time. And then as soon as they woke us up, they were like, you got 20 minutes to grab whatever you can.
He says he found out about this camp from a homeless advocate and decided to come here by walking 6 miles from 168 to downtown at Broadway and San Benito. Des Martinez runs the camp as part of her nonprofit, We Are Not Invisible. She calls it a safe camp.
You know, I thank God that she let me in, because if not, I would be out just wandering around.
Martinez says Jackson was one of several people who arrived as a result of the Highway 168 cleanup.
I knew they were coming. I didn't think they were coming that fast. And when I showed up, my whole walkway was like full of stuff, people. I just felt like I just wanted to break down right then and there.
Martinez originally had 15 people at her encampment, but the highway displacement more than doubled that number to 32. Unlike other homeless organizations that partner with the city of Fresno, Martinez doesn't receive public funding. At last week's city council meeting, she pleaded for help.
We just need food and shelter and warmth and sanitation just to survive until you help us. That's what we need.
Under Mayor Jerry Dyer, the Project Off-Ramp Initiative has prioritized moving those experiencing homelessness off city highways and into shelters. Typically, the city partners with Caltrans in the operations, but H. Spees, Fresno's Director of Housing and Homeless Services, says the city wasn't involved in this cleanup.
That was a Caltrans action, unilateral Caltrans action. I will say this, that because of the chaos that created, city was asked to help.
City of Fresno sanitation vehicles stepped in to move property at the request of the displaced to Martinez's camp. Caltrans has not returned our phone call to clarify what happened with the operation. The news about the transfer to Martinez's camp came as a surprise to council members. Miguel Arias and Esmeralda Soria immediately spoke out in support of Martinez.
But we can't leave her just kind of out there without providing resources.
When we use our vehicles to transport people, we are now responsible for where we transport them to and whether they have services.
But the discussion sparked a debate as to whether the city should direct its funds to encampments. Councilmember Gary Bredefeld was against it.
I don't want the city council to come up with money to give in any way to Des Martinez, who has no background in mental health or anything else, a professional degree.
Council members will need to decide whether to fund the encampment. They will come back to discuss a plan on April 8th. In the meantime, Martinez is on her own. And she says, for now, she has no other choice but to help the displaced.
We're not trying to take over the city with more encampments. We're trying to provide a safe place because the lack of resources that we have in Fresno, there's not enough beds and there's not going to be enough beds.
After the city council meeting, Martinez says the community stepped in to fill the gap. Donors gave supplies and funds, which are already being put to use.
This is one of the sheds that was actually donated, and this is a big old 10 by 10 portable shed.
Martinez pulls up a tarp covering for the shed to show off what's inside.
We were able to utilize the funds that were donated to purchase supplies and purchase shelving units, because now not everything's on the floor in boxes.
New shelves are lined up and organized into sections for toiletries and pantry items. She shows off a new box of solar panels and heavy-duty lights.
So with these solar panels, I'm going to hook up a lighting system so we can have lights, because that's kind of the worst things down here is not having any lights or not being able to see people.
Martinez says one of the most helpful new additions is more durable tent sheds with metal frames.
And it's much better.
The wind, this withholds the wind. Everything that we went through with the tents collapsing, that's what made me think of these. The frames are so much stronger.
Today, the wind is picking up and it's a struggle to build the first tent in the gusts. With a 12-foot ceiling and no ladder, it took five people to hoist and secure a tarp over one shed.
And then you'll put the piece that in there, and then we got to get these in the ground.
Andrea Harper is hunched over a box of parts to build the shed. She's a longtime member of the street family.
There's any type of, any job, like, I'll do it.
Harper has just built one tent. She has three more to go. It's been a rush to accommodate all the extra people from Highway 168.
Because the way we're getting people in is like we don't have nothing up for them when they come in. So I want to make sure we have them up.
Martinez and Harper plan out how to add more tents.
So it's 15 by 15, 12 by 12.
Spacing them 12 feet apart to comply with CDC regulations. Standing a few yards away from Harper, Ernie De Leon is busy clearing the ground for new tent space for the incoming people. He uses water to wet the ground. It softens the dirt so he can sweep and clear away rocks and debris.
I mean, it took a lot of hours, but I did it. I mean, but I had help with some of my brothers and sisters out here.
Des Martinez says he's been pulling 12-hour shifts to get the camp cleared for new tents. She's also working such long days that she's sleeping at the camp. She says her friends here keep her going.
Like if they see me down, they always lift me up. They always tell me, you know, the thing that keeps me going is when I break, it's them that hold me together. Nobody else, it's them, because they see me break down a lot lately.
Until the city decides whether to help fund the encampment, Martinez is running it with donations given on her website. We are not invisible. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Sarith Hawk.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Public health agencies share official information about COVID-19 in many languages: Spanish, sometimes Hmong, and American Sign Language. But one language has been largely missing. That's Punjabi. In spite of that, FM89's Carrie Klein reports many who speak Punjabi have kept this country running during the pandemic.
A little dirty, but, you know, not bad.
The cab of Sunny Graywall's 18-wheeler is neat and tidy. He's got bunk beds with red checkered sheets and gray interior cabinets that hide a fridge, microwave, and a snack stash with sweets from his native India.
We call it gur, you know, G-U-R. You can put it in a tea, or you can have a like small piece after the food.
Graywall is a truck owner-operator based in Fresno. He drives 150,000 miles a year, delivering produce and cleaning supplies like hand sanitizer to and from the East Coast, Midwest, and the South.
if nurses want to, you know, take care of you, they need the stuff that we bring. Do you want to buy a food to stay home? Do you want to stock the food in your house? We bring that food.
The state of California designates truckers as essential workers, but that status hasn't materialized into any advantages. No requirements that rest stops be open, no hazard pay, and no priority access to the vaccine. Graywall is also one of an estimated hundreds of thousands of truckers who are sick, S-I-K-H, from the northern state of Punjab. A trucking association estimates Punjabi Sikhs control as much as 40% of California's trucking industry, and yet few public health departments offer COVID information in Punjabi.
It makes me feel left over, you know?
And that lack of information in Punjabi has consequences for the whole community, says Manpreet Kaur of the nonprofit Jakara Movement, especially in the early days of the pandemic.
The information was just always missing, or it was too late, or it was shared in a way that wasn't easily understood.
Take the day last year, she was standing outside a Sikh temple known as a Gurdwara in Bakersfield.
And a woman was like, you know, are you in line? Can you move up? And I'm like, no, you know, I'm trying to keep a distance. And she's like, no, this is not how COVID is passed. You know, it's from surfaces. And I'm like, that is at least 6 month old information.
It's difficult to quantify how the virus has affected California's Punjabi Sikh population, but many cities with large diaspora, like Livingston and Yuba City, have case rates far higher than their county averages. The Jakara Movement estimates at least 4 Punjabi Sikh workers were among the 12 who died in COVID-19 outbreaks at Foster Farms plants in Fresno and Merced counties.
Punjabis tend to be in food processing, trucking, all of the essential work that has high exposure.
So early on, the Jakara Movement began translating important health information and sometimes adding a cultural spin, like how to wear a mask with a turban. They visit gurdwaras to register people for tests and vaccines. And this video about the vaccine featuring Punjabi Sikh doctors has more than 800 views on Instagram.
Internal medicine doctor. I COVID vaccine lavan.
Jaspreet Singha, another Punjabi Sikh trucker based in Fresno, says there's an intimacy in hearing the news in his native tongue, even though he's proficient in English.
It makes you feel more recognized, makes you feel proud that, yes, your hard work is paying off when the country needed you.
That's why he and many other truckers swear by Punjabi Radio USA. A radio station with 24 hours of news, music, and religious programs.
Punjabi Radio USA sun rahe sare himanjog ate satkar srotiyan.
Since the pandemic began, the station has doubled its news programming, and call-in shows are almost singularly focused on COVID. Engineer and announcer Raj Karanbir Singh says initial questions focused on lockdowns and basic health precautions.
After that, everybody's starting to feel the pinch of this pandemic, especially, you know, financially. So what kind of help are we getting? What is government doing on it?
Shows are available on FM and AM radio, internet stream, smartphone app, WhatsApp groups, and a call-in number to listen via phone. And they're all in Punjabi.
That is basically our main mission, that our community is well-informed, and their issues are taken seriously by the policymakers or the lawmakers.
Most counties with any information in Punjabi offer just selected documents or an automated translation via Google Translate. Singh says it's frustrating to see his community left in the dark.
I know people can argue, okay, they need to know English. Okay, they need to know English, but how are they reaching out? There is no outreach to them. Even the health officials or the departments, they are not contacting us.
Until now. Singh says the State Department of Health has gotten in touch to run a vaccine information campaign. And earlier this week, the state made its online vaccine scheduling tool, MyTurn, available in Punjabi. By mid-April, all Californians over age 16 will be eligible for the COVID vaccine. That includes truckers, though Jaspreet Singha says they should have been prioritized earlier, alongside first responders. Sunny Graywall agrees.
They should start thinking about truckers seriously, how much we help. I know it's our job, but we still are humans too.
His suggestion? Offer the shots at rest stops, where so many truckers pass by every day. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein. Thank you.
You just heard Carrie Klein's report about the struggles of truckers of Punjabi Sikh descent to obtain COVID-related information in their native language. Now she's here to share more about the experience of truckers during the pandemic as part of our weekly COVID-19 update. Carrie, welcome back.
Thanks, Kathleen.
So as usual, let's begin with a status report from around the valley.
Right. So as we've been saying for the last number of weeks now, cases and hospitalization rates continue to fall throughout the valley, which is really good news. One measure that has not improved in the last week, and in fact has gotten worse, is the number of people dying of COVID. We've run across this a couple of times, and it's often due to a backlog in death certificates being processed, though for this week, I have not gotten answers to, for exactly why this might have been. However, if we look at the state reopening blueprint, most of the state has now graduated out of the purple most restrictive tier, but that progress has been much slower here in the valley. Only 3 of the 7 counties we cover have advanced. That's Tulare and Kern, which are in the next step up, the red tier, and Mariposa, which is in orange, one tier above that. This week, however, Fresno, Madera, and Kings counties have qualified to move to red as early as next week, and Merced is still stuck in purple for at least the next 2 weeks. As for vaccine progress, now more than 900,000 doses have been administered in our region, and almost 300,000 people are fully vaccinated, and so it's almost guaranteed that we're going to hit 1 million doses in the next week.
And that news accompanies even bigger news announced by the governor yesterday.
Yes, that's right. So Newsom just announced yesterday that on April 1st, the state will be opening up vaccine eligibility to all Californians over 50, and by April 15th, to all Californians over 16. That's huge news, and that's because we're anticipating a sharp increase in supply from around 1.8 million doses per week right now to around 3 million doses per week by the end of April. Of course, one of the buzzwords we keep hearing in all of this is vaccine hesitancy. And presumably the longer that vaccines are available, the more health officials will begin to encounter people who are eligible but who don't actually want the vaccine. So we'll see if the state really will be administering the shots as quickly as they're anticipating.
There's been more and more information swirling recently about COVID variants. What's the latest news on that here in the Valley?
Right. Well, for a long time, we escaped much of the scourge of variants, but that's likely because we just lagged behind the rest of the state in testing for them. The California variant has now been detected in at least Kings County, although likely much more than that because it's been found in thousands of samples. And the so-called UK variant has been detected in at least Kings, Fresno, and Madera counties. And remember that variants are natural mutations that occur as the virus replicates and jumps from host to host. Some variants are nothing to be concerned about, but both of these variants do appear to be more severe and more contagious than the original strain. It also appears that the UK variant does not respond as well to monoclonal antibodies, which is now one of the standard treatments for severe disease. So that is a concern.
And do the vaccines protect against these variants?
Well, clinical trials were, of course, mostly finished before these variants emerged, but it is believed that the vaccines are less effective against them than against the original strain. However, they're still somewhat effective. So health officials still argue that the best protection against any variant is vaccination in tandem with avoiding close contact and continuing to wear masks in public.
Well, let's turn back now to the truck drivers you spoke to for your report. What were the early days of the pandemic like for people who make their living on the road?
Well, those were the days that those of us not deemed essential workers were told to stay home, right? You know, reduce exposure. We didn't exactly know how the virus spread. And so understandably, that was scary for people driving for days or weeks at a time who didn't know what they were driving into or what they were bringing back to their families. And so I spoke about this with Lovepreet Singh. He's a trucker in Bakersfield. Through an interpreter, he told me he remained working at first, but then changed his mind.
He was seeing just every day the White House and on Twitter, everyone was posting like the newly updated casualties as well as infection rates. And so that worried him and scared him. So he stayed home for like 7 to 10 days.
Now, a lot of the rest areas closed their doors during the pandemic. What exactly did that mean for truckers looking for services?
Well, it means pretty much what you'd imagine. You know, some truckers had to drive huge stretches of road, hundreds of miles with no bathroom. Sonny Graywall, a trucker owner-operator based in Fresno, told me that, yeah, sometimes you'd have to park on a shoulder and use the bathroom on the side of the highway. Not easy to navigate with an 18-wheeler. But he was more concerned with sleeping. The cabs of these huge trucks are outfitted with beds and fridges and everything a truck driver might need for a long haul, but they need to be parked somewhere safe in order to sleep.
And when you get on I-40 going to Arizona, there's only two rest areas within 150 mile radius, and they both were closed for like a year. And I saw people, like I said before, people were parking on the ramps, so dark ramp, no lighting, nothing. Anything can happen to you over there.
He also saw trucks parked on the shoulder on the highway. Graywall says exposure like that puts truckers at risk not only of accidents, but also crime, like robberies. The good news, he says, is that most rest areas have opened back up at this point, although parking had been in short supply even before the pandemic.
But I imagine food and supplies were in such high demand early on that truckers were at least well paid for their work, right?
No, not even. You know, Graywall told me that pay rates plummeted at the beginning of the pandemic, partly a function of supply and demand. Many warehouses were closed or had really reduced staff, so suddenly there were far more trucks available than could be loaded and unloaded. And so with a glut in supply, brokers suddenly didn't have to pay as much. And for some truckers, they lost money as they worked. Here's Jaspreet Singha, another truck owner-operator in Fresno, talking about freight rates.
For example, say the freight rate goes 55 to 6 grand to the Midwest, and the rates drop to 3 grand. So they were literally half the price.
Another function of this supply-demand problem is that some warehouses were so slow in processing trucks that they'd have to wait hours or days to load or unload. Sonny Graywall said he once had to wait 27 hours just to pick up a load of cleaning supplies.
Wow. So, as you reported, all three of the men you spoke with lamented that the state hadn't prioritized them for the vaccine early on. Would they all get it once they get the chance?
Yes, all three would. And of course, it's looking like it'll just be in April that likely they'll be eligible for it if they hadn't already. You know, two of them shared doubts about how quickly the vaccine was approved, but that they'd most likely still get it, you know, once they qualify. But they still feel that elected officials and health authorities turned their back on truck drivers by not making them eligible earlier. They've been looking for any silver linings they can find, like signs on highway thanking truckers for their work. And Lovepreet Singh said some very nice people on a stop in Florida actually shared bread and bottled water with him.
Wow. A nice note to end on. Carrie, thank you so much for your reporting.
You're welcome, Kathleen.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Members of the Asian American community have been sounding alarms over the dramatic increase in anti-Asian rhetoric and violence over the course of the pandemic. But it was another tragedy. The mass shooting in Atlanta that left 8 dead, 6 of whom were women of Asian descent, that centered a national conversation about racism and discrimination against Asian Americans. To learn more about how this moment is being experienced in the San Joaquin Valley, I spoke with Nikiko Masumoto, an organic farmer and artist, Gina Lu Gong, a lecturer of Asian American Studies at Fresno State, Jerry Yang Johnson, trustee and board member for the California Wellness Foundation, and Yashu Liang, a professor and licensed psychologist. Jerry, you wrote a moving, heartbreaking letter to the editor that was published in the Fresno Bee recently, in which you shared an idea that some have. It's an idea that I have heard from non-Asian friends that anti-Asian hate just isn't really much of an issue here in the Central Valley. What is your response to that?
Well, thank you, Kathleen, for this conversation. And I feel really privileged and in a place of privilege to be able to have even written and penned my rage and anger and frustration on paper and have it read by so many in our community and beyond. And what I really meant by that is that I think that we've long been seen, we've long been silenced and not seen as really an integral part of our community. And so people, you know, are still questioning, is there anti-Asian violence and hate crime in our communities? Because we ourselves have not found or have not been in a position to have been heard, even when we did address or complain or point out anti-racism and attacks against our community. So for instance, you know, I myself have been victim to, you know, racist attacks, both verbal and actual physical, and not once have I reported it. And so that's what I was trying to allude to, that so many of us don't feel like we have a space or a place to even report these things and for it to be addressed.
This is Gina. Thank you, Jerry, for bringing this up and for talking about your recent op-ed piece. And I it just came up in my Facebook timeline that exactly a year ago today, I wrote a letter to the Fresno Bee to bring attention to the fact that our so-called leaders, in this case it was Fresno County Supervisor Steve Brandow and Congressman Kevin McCarthy, had continued to refer to this as the Chinese virus and the Kung flu because they were taking their cues from our former president. And when they were using these terms in public spaces, I think, and it was in an actual meeting, nobody really said anything, and I thought that was a big problem. And I raised that, and I wrote about it in the Bee. And I had said back then, a year ago today, that this kind of hate speech just indicates that people still consider Asian Americans in our communities foreigners, and they don't think that there are going to be any kind of repercussions by using this kind of speech. And sadly, it took, you know, these tragedies in Atlanta to bring more attention to the fact that it is happening, even though maybe we haven't had, you know, horrible acts of violence yet in our communities. I think if we continue to let this kind of hate speech continue, I think it just may happen. And I think we need to take responsibility and hold our leaders accountable for their speech.
If I could jump in here, this is Nikiko. I want to make a connection. Both what Gina and Jerry are articulating is really resonant with me. There's a way in which anti-Asian racism is so steeped in our culture that we even dismiss claims of those of us who experience it. Mm-hmm. And I want to bring Yashu in here because I know, Yashu, can you help us talk about the spectrum, the way in which the hate speech that Gina articulates is linked to more violent forms of racism? Because I know this is one of your areas of expertise.
Well, I think, you know, turning a human being into a thing is almost the first step, you know, towards justifying violence against a person, right? And so we see that in a lot of the context, racism, homophobia, and always the same process. A person is dehumanized and violence becomes inevitable. And so I think that's what we have seen in this past year, and now it erupted this past month. So that's what I have observed. And so objectification and really the dehumanization really leads to violence.
Gina, you teach Asian American Studies at Fresno State. Help us better understand how race intersects with gender when it pertains to this kind of marginalizing Asian women.
Well, I think race definitely, as you pointed out, intersects with gender for all women, and for especially for all racial minority women. For Asian American women, it is definitely very closely intertwined, and it takes on a different dimension, though, because of the ways that Asian American women have been portrayed in the media by popular culture, by, you know, songs, by movies, when we are portrayed at all, I should say, because there really are not a whole lot of portrayals up until maybe fairly recently. But these images have really led to people assuming that Asian women are these commodities, that they are property that they can control, either as their China doll or their geisha girl or what have you. And so we're invisibilized, basically, by every time that somebody makes reference to these shootings and says that these shootings happened because the perpetrator was trying to eliminate a temptation, where basically he's reducing Asian women as these objects of his desire, and that we're somehow at fault for tempting him. And so this is a whole big it's a big problem, obviously, wrapped up in many, many decades of objectification by mainstream United States society.
You know, I want to stay on this idea of sort of sisterhood. Nikiko, I understand that you recently helped to facilitate a healing circle for AAPI women and trans women, you know, following this awful mass shooting in Atlanta. What can you tell us about that gathering and how sisterhood and community is helping to process the range of emotions that have been activated?
Yeah, Kathleen, the truth is that even the spark of that idea to hold the healing circle really came from the four of us here, Yashu, Gina, Jerry, and I. We automatically reached out to each other during last week to try to process, and through our energies wanted to extend the circle and open it wider. For me personally, and I know all of us could weigh in on this, the ability to have a space to share openly, to be vulnerable in processing the pain that we're feeling, that sense of sisterhood, that sense of belonging to one another is one of my lifelines. It really is. And I am so tremendously grateful. I'm also deeply saddened. It's so heavy to hear how the events, particularly of last week, but beyond just last week, the rise in temperature in anti-Asian violence and harassment for the past year. It is painful to hear from each other that there's been lots of different experiences. And at the same time, I know that the path forward must be us. It must be censoring our voices. It must be us realizing our power to move forward.
And if I could just add, this is Jerry. I think it's important for us to see each other, to give space and to see each other, and to elevate and hear each other's voices, and to come together in what you call sisterhood, because I think we've all felt in different ways silenced for so long, and that part of changing and shifting our culture is to recognize each other's voices and support and elevate each other's voices in this space, even if it's done just in a way of self-healing and your own journey, but that self-healing and that journey is really contributing to this larger need and movement to heal our communities and to dismantle racism. And to give, you know, I don't know if power is the right word, or give, just to lift up the AAPI women in our communities.
Yashu, given your training as a psychologist, I'd be really interested to hear your thoughts about how this past year and the increase in hate and violence is affecting the mental health of the AAPI community.
The obvious thing that we have observed is the heightened anxiety. So there's a lot of fear, a lot of distrust, and this past few weeks have been a lot of anger. You also see a lot of people have changed their behaviors. So, for example, some people are avoiding certain spaces. Some people are strategizing with family members how to react to a potential racist attack. And especially for some of our community members who actually have gone through wars before they migrate to the U.S., it is adding another layer of trauma when they observe all these incidents.
And so this is really impacting all of us profoundly, and especially for a lot of our community members. And also, I also heard that some of the community members start to question when they go out, and they are more vigilant. And now they start to doubt if some of the encounter are racist encounter. And so it's interesting. It's bringing a lot of kind of self-awareness and also this distrust in them, and that make people doubt if any kind of unpleasant encounter or any microaggression. So that's what I have observed.
Does anyone else want to weigh in on this issue of mental health?
I wanted to just pick up on what Yashu just mentioned about people being extra vigilant, and I think this definitely has some impact, and it may have some repercussions for our public education system now that they're opening up and parents are being asked if they're going to send their kids back to school. If our schools are not what we would consider safe places to send our children, I think we need to question whether Asian American parents are going to be sending their kids back to school at the same rates as everybody else. There have already been studies that have shown that across the nation, a lot of Asian American students are not going back in person at the same rates as other students. And I think it is precisely for these reasons, and particularly in areas like New York, Philadelphia, Chicago, but large urban areas where they're tend to be a lot more violent incidences and hate crimes. But, you know, we can ask ourselves if our children have heard any kind of hate speech at our schools and if that may impact their desire to go back to school and parents' desire to want to send them back into those environments.
There was somebody else who was going to jump in. I don't want to cut anyone off.
No, it was Jerry. I also just wanted to add that, you know, in my piece that I wrote, I really tried to focus on also the fact that white supremacy has had such a stranglehold on our community, and this idea of, like, you know, being, you know, Asians have long been referred to as the model minority, right? And being referred to and minimized to just this model minority, or on the opposite end of that is these hypersexualized images and objectifying our women, is that we're not seen as our whole selves. And so a lot of that gets internalized into ourselves and our communities, and the pain and the hurt and continues, and the violence continues as well. I cannot be on this call and panel with all of you without addressing and pointing out that just in this last week, three Hmong women have been murdered by their partners or spouses, or allegedly murdered by their spouses and partners. And we have to make the connection between this idea that women, you know, this gender issue we've been talking about, and this reducing people to objects, reducing people to property or to not being even human, gets internalized and perpetuated within our communities.
I'm wondering if anyone else wants to say more about this idea of the model minority myth and the negative consequences that come with that label.
Well, this is Gina. I can comment on that since this is in my wheelhouse of things that I teach. But when I teach my students about the model minority myth, I'm always very conscientious about the way that it positions Asian Americans and the way that it was framed and the way that it was used. Basically, it was introduced in the 60s at the height of the civil rights movement by a white sociologist who was using Asian Americans as this quote-unquote model that other minorities should try to emulate, because according to him and his research, he found that Asian Americans were reaching these heights of success even though they had these years of discrimination before them. And in the way that he framed it, he was saying that Asian Americans are these models and that basically, why can't other minorities, namely the black and brown minorities in our country, try to aspire to be more like Asians? And I think it's very damaging and very dangerous to be in that position where Asian Americans are being used as this racial wedge to drive apart our communities of color. And it's something that has had incredible lasting power. I know that it is still around, even though this myth is now, 40, 60 years old now. And it's something that permeates every facet of our society, unfortunately, including our school systems, where Asian Americans often are not counted as underserved minorities, where they don't necessarily qualify for certain programs because they are not considered underrepresented or underserved. And it's important to make the distinction that Asian Americans are such a broad encompass such a broad part of such a broad spectrum, from very low socioeconomic status to very high. And it really depends on their immigration, when they immigrated, their family background, all of these things. And to lump every Asian American ethnicity into this broad Asian American model minority stereotype is incredibly damaging, as I said, and it is not useful. It also imparts this kind of feeling of trauma and stress upon students who can't ever feel like they can attain that kind of success, yet they feel this outside pressure put on them by their teachers, by society, that they feel like they should be successful, they should be smarter, they should be working harder than they do. And so that's very, very quickly, a little bit about the model minority myth. But it was another researcher talked about the racial triangulation of Asian Americans, and that really is it's directly related to this model minority myth, where Asians are supposedly held up as being adjacent or with their proximity to whiteness. And that's not necessarily something that Asians have ever defined for ourselves. It's more something that has been a label that's been put upon us by our white supremacy society.
If I could just add, this is Nikiko. I just want to pause, and I'm sitting with what Gina has just articulated about the harm that the model minority myth purveys on us as Asian Americans, and not only us, but connecting to part of Jerry's op-ed, what is being articulated, I think, right now, and what I'm feeling very emotional about, is that we as Asian Americans are not having the same experience during this pandemic that white Americans are. And similarly, as we've seen, and I know, Kathleen, you and Valley Public Radio have been reporting on the health disparities and inequities of the effects of COVID on our communities of color. So there's a way in which this model minority myth, right, it works into the hands of privileging whiteness and to ignoring, excluding, to our own peril, everyone else. And I think that it's interesting to kind of pause in this moment and think back a year ago. There was this tiny window of time, maybe a couple weeks, where I felt, as an American, there was this moment of, we're all in this together, right? I mean, we had so much empathy and compassion for our healthcare heroes, you know, and then very quickly, I feel like that disappeared. And now, as we are beginning to, emerge into this new normal, this new phase, what pains me so much is it feels like people don't understand people of color, Black Americans, Indigenous people, Asian Americans. We have been experiencing a completely different pandemic magnified by racism. And this is, we have to get over this as a country. We have to heal through this. Otherwise, these cycles, I fear, are just going to keep repeating themselves.
How can we, as individuals and as a community, stand in solidarity with you? And not just today, you know, while we're having, when so many people are having these conversations about anti-Asian hate, but in the months and years that follow, you know, after this horrific crime has moved out of the news cycle and after we've gotten through this pandemic, what can we do to support you and to address these issues for once and for all?
This is Jerry. I'm happy to start off, but I know, you know, Nakiko, Yashu, and Gina, we've all been having this conversation and have got some really, you know, some ideas about next steps. But first, you're right. This is really, Kathleen, this is really a moment of collective action among BIPOC communities to dismantle racism. There are many, many organizations in our community who've been at the front lines of doing this work. How do we continue to support them and lift them up and invest in them and the work that they're trying to do? You know, building the leadership of our young people in our community, addressing the disparities that our community face, lifting up voices. But I think also part of that is what we're doing here today, which is changing the narrative on Asian American communities and really calling upon our leaders, media, our neighbors, our friends, to stop using the stereotypes to include us in decision making, to invest in our communities, and to see us as a very diverse, complex community. And so I will stop there, but I know, you know, my sisters here on the panel also have more to add to that.
This is Yashu. I do think that building a cross-group coalition is actually very important. And so not just building, you know, a coalition across racial group, but also building coalition among ethnic groups, even within our API communities and across sectors and disciplines and across generations. You know, if you see Nikiko, Jerry, and Gina and me here, we represent different sectors and different disciplines and different generations in the U.S. And I think that's what the power is to be able to work across all the spectrum and groups and to come together to really resist a racist framework.
Yeah, this is Gina. I'll speak, and then I'll let Nakiko wrap it up because she's always way more eloquent than any of us are. But I wanted to just add that to have these conversations is very important, and this is something that is fairly new that I don't think I have seen Asian Americans be centered as much as in the last week, let's say, where usually Asian Americans are included as, oh, you know, we have a black voice, a brown voice, now we need an Asian voice, and it's kind of a tokenism. And it's been like that for many decades, unfortunately. But now people are very interested in hearing about Asian American voices and hearing about our experiences because they hadn't heard them before, or maybe we had been saying them, but people hadn't been listening. So I think it is important to uplift our own voices and to encourage other people to share their experiences as well, so that people in all different sectors, all ethnicities, all races can hear. Something that I just did yesterday, was I spoke on a couple of podcasts of different friends. One was an African-American friend, and another one was a white woman who is a social worker in Finland, of all places. And she wanted to talk about different aspects of racism and how racism can infiltrate social work even. And so I think having these kinds of opportunities to share our stories and to use them to build bridges across places that you wouldn't necessarily think of is very helpful, and it can be something that our non-Asian allies can easily do, is to just, you know, open themselves to hearing these stories and encourage others to do the same. I know that I personally reached out to my daughter's principal and to a member of the school district board to ask that they release statements in support of Asian American communities and to condemn any kind of hate speech on their campuses or just in general. And And I think that's something that others can do as well. You don't have to be Asian to call upon your school leaders or your local leaders to do something, to voice your support and to condemn what's happening now. So that's what I would say.
This is Nikiko. I just want to amplify the powerful ideas that Jerry, Yashu, and Gina are articulating, the idea of investing in leadership, the idea of coalition building, the idea of making space for voices and listening to them. Those are all incredibly powerful. And we, four of us and many more people have been in these conversations and are going to continue to be in these conversations. When I think about the work ahead, the actions to do, I tend to think about three levels, and this is just my approach, and there's many other approaches, thinking about what I can do individually, thinking about what I can do in community with community, and then thinking about what we can do structurally. And so if it's on an individual level, depending on what your point of entry is, if you're not a person of color, if you're a white person, looking at your bookshelf, how many people of color are you reading? Who are you listening to? What journalists are you listening to? Are you listening to Kathleen Schock? Are you populating your life with voices of people of color? I mean, that's like a simple question to ask yourself. In terms of community, I ask myself over and over again, how can I be of service to our youth, to our elders? How can I walk alongside other communities in calls for justice, in work of healing? And then structurally, I keep thinking about the long walk to justice and the reality that we might not see all of the healing that we need in our lifetimes, but it is our job to carry and run this leg of the relay. And so I think a lot about what are the things and the behaviors and the practices that build my own endurance. And so undergirding, I think all of this are values, values of courage and values of being ferocious in and through difficulty, struggle, and discomfort. Those for me are the values that help guide me through. And with my sisters, Jerry, Gina, Yashu, I listen to them. That is key. And those are the actions that really motivate me to keep going.
Well, Nikiko Masumoto, Yashu Liang, Jerry Yang Johnson, and Gina Liu Gong, it has been an honor having your voices here on Valley Edition. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you,
Kathleen.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Daniel, Carrie Klein, Madi Bolaños, and Sarith Hawk. Technical support is from Marv Allen and Don Weaver. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, accepting nominations now for the 2022 James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards at irvineawards.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, ensuring the voices of Californians are heard in California's decisions about healthcare. On the web at chcf.org/voices.